All right, you guys, you got to forgive me on this one. I'm new at this. I'm not a audiovisual expert. I have no degree in any of this stuff. I just don't know what I'm doing here. But I wanted to be a little more detailed in my approach to answering your questions on Instagram. So here it goes. If you guys listen to this and like it, please share it. If you guys don't like it, tell me how I can improve. You guys are awesome. Thanks for following.
From Uncle Jimmy, right. And this one's from Santa, and there would be that one.
All right, next question is Sean Houston, 119, asked, do I prefer the Leupold Mark 5 HD or the Vortex Gen 2 Razor? And I'll tell you, I've only owned the Vortex. I desire to own the Leupold, and I probably will soon. I will tell you that I think they're pretty fairly even across the board as far as glass and all the features and whatnot. I would say I give a Vortex a big strike against the weight of the Gen 2 Razor, because if you don't want the weight, some people do, if you don't want the weight, that thing is a brick. It is like 40 ounces or something without looking. It's very heavy. The other strike against the Vortex Gen 2 Razor is the turret on top. I guess both of them technically. I had a match where I was shooting my Gen 2 Razor, and I did great except for one stage where I got, I can't remember, a 0 or a 1 or something awful, and that's, you know, 0 or 1 out of 10 attempts, and I couldn't figure out why I was missing, and I just kind of went back and diagnosed it, and I determined that the way the turret is designed on that scope, no matter what you do, the turret will click. If it's loosened or tight, no matter what, it'll click. So you have this clicking feedback, and you feel like, okay, I'm dialing up, shoot, I'm dialing up, shoot. And you have this kind of feedback. Well, on any other scope, just about, there may be some that are excluded in this, you will not feel clicking, you'll feel sliding. You'll feel just like you're turning, like, you know, something smooth. And when those set screws in the scope are tight, it'll actually, the turret itself is a cap over an internal mechanism that's actually turning, you know, things inside. So I think that's the biggest strike against it. I really don't like how they do the zeroing and how you take the cap off, or the little center piece off, and you have to dial, you know, that little center screw in and out. But I think that ultimately I'm looking forward to the Leupold, and I think I think the price point is certainly there. It's a very competitive scope. It's smaller than most in size. I'd like that too. It's going to stay out of the way of some barricades, but I think that for me, if I was to buy one today, it would certainly be the Leupold. You can't go wrong, but I would buy the Leupold. But I think that ultimately I'm looking forward to the Leupold. I think the price point is certainly there. It's a very competitive scope. It's smaller than most in size. I'd like that too. It's going to stay out of the way of some barricades, but I think that for me, if I was to buy one today, it would certainly be the Leupold. You can't go wrong, but I would buy the Leupold. Next question is, what do I think about GRS stocks? Well, I have experience with those, actually. There's very few people that I know of that do. One of my good friends owned one, and he had on a CZ-455 with a Lilja barrel, and it was quite a nice rifle. I was really, really a fan of it. He didn't keep that forever. He actually sold it to another one of my friends who loves it. But I think that it's a very good example of incredible craftsmanship, Very, very good attention to detail, and you're probably never going to get one that doesn't fit perfectly and do what it's supposed to do. That being said, I think that there are a lot of other options for the money too. I think I would probably rather have something like an XLR Envy or a Manners, or obviously a Jay Allen would be amazing. There's a lot of choices. I think that we're living in kind of an amazing time where our options for these extremely, extremely nice things are almost limitless. We live in a time where people can buy a lathe or a mill that's computer, you know, programmable, and you can create just incredible things with really, you know, no degree needed and no, you know, super advanced training needed too. If you can program a CNC, you can make whatever your heart desires. So it's an amazing time, and there's so much competition in this capitalist business that we're in, and it's just exciting because we have, you know, 10 years ago there was basically Manners or Macmillan, you know, and it seems like today there's a whole lot of amazing choices. And you know, obviously competition drives drives prices down, and that's always good. It drives innovation. So I think it's a really neat thing. But the GRS is amazing. I think that, you know, consider if you're ordering it direct from GRS, they're in Norway, if I'm not mistaken. It could take quite a while to get that stock in. I think my friend waited several months for his. It had to be imported through, I think, someone in Vegas, if I'm not mistaken. And anyway, it just took a long time. That may have changed too. That's been a couple of years since this all happened. But anyway, I think that the GRS is an incredible, beautiful stock with great hardware for the quick adjustments of the cheek rest and the length of pull. But again, I think that there's a lot of other options that you could be very happy with. Mark's X-Men asked, what do I think of the 6mm BR or 6mm bench rest? Well, it's funny you should ask, because I have a 6mm barrel coming to me from Benchmark. I have noticed that there has been a trend in low recoil and high ballistic coefficient guns and or calibers. And I think that that's a really, really good option. There's almost an endless number of cartridges based off of the 6mm BR. One of them I'm shooting already is a 22 BR, so it's a converted down from 6 to 22. And another one is the 6 Dasher, 6 BRA, 6 BRX. There's just tons of them that are very, very similar, but slight differences in the headspace and the shoulder angles and things like that. When I'm choosing a caliber, I like simplicity, so that there's no neck turning required. Neck turning is what you may need to do. It's kind of thinning the thickness of the neck. You may need to do it depending on the reamer you're using for your cartridge, but it's usually, if you're doing it because of the reamer, you're doing it because you're sizing down, say, a 6.5 by 47 down to 22.47. So that neck thickness is getting pretty thick because the brass, you know, has nowhere else to go. So you shave that down with this tool and it thins that neck out. The other reason you may neck turn is because you just want your brass to be concentric and, you know, more perfect than it already is. So sometimes you use calipers or measure one side of the neck thickness and it might be 13 thousandths of an inch, and the other side might be 15 thousandths, and you're thinking, okay, well, it's not centered now, because when you're seating it in the case, it's going to be, you know, a thou or two off, and that'll, you know, be a negative effect on your accuracy. Well, that's very common in bench rest shooting, and people just do it because they want every little ounce of accuracy they can. People like me, I'd rather not neck turn. It's a pretty big headache, and I think it's just not worth my time. So when I choose my calibers or reamers, for example, my 224 Grendel, that reamer or those reamers I own, I specifically designed them so that you can size down 6.5 Grendel down all the way down to 5.56. So it's a full millimeter size down, or, you know, it's a couple of calibers down. And I just really wanted to not have to neck turn. So my reamer specs allow for that extra neck thickness. So it's okay. You're still having, as the round fires, it's still going to expand and fire and release the bullet, and the neck's not going to be touching the bullet anymore, and it's going to just go down range. So anyway, I suspect that one of the bigger headaches in that family of cartridges, in the 6BR family, is fire forming. So for example, the 6-dasher, if you want to shoot that, you're required to shoot rounds, and the, you know, very high pressure 50,000 psi plus is going to expand that brass out and mold it to the shape of your chamber. Much of this obviously is known to a lot of you guys. I just want to talk about, you know, in case someone doesn't understand this stuff, but that means the first shot is going to be a fire form shot, and then after that, that brass is now formed to the chamber, and now you can, you know, bump the shoulder as usual, and you can just kind of load it as if you normally would. But that first bullet, the powder and the primer are not totally wasted. You can still compete with it and shoot with it, but for my understanding and my experience, they're going to be a little less consistent and certainly slower because there's less capacity. And part of that horsepower that you're generating with that pressure is kind of neutered almost, because you're using some of that power to expand that brass out to the chamber. So I've heard of people, I know a guy that's won a match fire forming, but for me it's just a little bit of a headache because it's just one extra step, and instead of just buying brass and shooting it, it's, you got to go shoot all that brass. So if you have 100 or 200 or 500, that's a lot of bullets, a lot of powder, a lot of primers that you're just kind of, you know, it's not going to be your best shooting probably. So that's kind of my take on the BR. I love my 22 BR because it's shooting a very high BC bullet, very fast. I'm shooting an 88 grain ELD at 3,040 feet per second roughly. And that bullet is, you know, 20 cents a piece. It's very affordable. It shoots really fast. Here in my elevation, my atmosphere here, I did a calculation out, you know, seeing where it would become subsonic. And at about 1,850 yards, that little tiny thing is now becoming subsonic. So it's an amazing little cartridge. It uses 12 less grains powder than the Creedmoor family. It even uses less than a lot of the 6-dasher because there's less capacity, of course. But as far as drop and wind, it pretty much beats everything out there. I got to think that an 88 grain bullet has less recoil than a 115 or 105 grain bullet too. So for me, I really like the 22 BR. I'm going to be building a 6 BR and I'm going to run 105 grain bullets through it because I just want to see if that extra little bit of speed is better than the added BC in the 115 grain DTAX. So my perspective is, I think that the BR, you probably shouldn't run the real heavy ones like the 115s or 112s, because you're going to lose a little bit of speed. But the 105s and even maybe something slightly lighter, even like a 95 or something like that, could be really, really neat. So I think that the BR is it's super forgiving to reload for too, by the way. So yeah, it's a great choice. Power Level Productions asks on Instagram, what bipod is my choice? Well, there's quite a few out now. As I said before, there's quite a few new products out. There's lots of people manufacturing now in this economy, I suppose. But I think that the science is getting so great. I started off using just a Harris bipod in competition, and I think that's of extremely high value. About $90 to $110 or so dollars, you can get I recommend a Harris S-BRM. So it's the swivel bench rest model. What that means is it swivels like a airplane yaws. So kind of rolls, I guess. It doesn't do the panning, which has no value to me at all. That's valuable to pan or roll like a, you know, if you're going to roll down a hill, you're rolling. It's valuable to do that because if you're on uneven ground, you can break that nut loose and level your gun and then tighten it down. What helps a ton with that bipod is a pod lock, and really most bipods should have that. Pod lock is kind of a aftermarket piece that's a big long kind of a nut with one long handle on it, so you can get a lot of torque on it and actually tighten it down. The factory Harris comes with just a knurled knob, and it, you can't really get it that tight with your fingers. It's just too fine. I then went from the Harris, got an Evolution Gunworks bipod, or Modular Evolution bipod, sorry. And that's a way bigger upgrade than a Harris. It's $300-something new, and it's got carbon fiber legs, and you can angle the legs 45 degrees forward or backwards and 90 degrees down, and you can extend the legs. You can do the tilt to the swivel motion as well. Comes with a pod lock, comes with a quick detach Picatinny by American Defense Manufacturing. You can take the legs off of the unit itself, and you can run longer legs, shorter legs, spiked feet, rubber feet. You can just do it all with that. It's a pretty neat little setup. It's a very, very high-end bipod. There's some that are crazier. I'm trying to think of the names of them now. Anyway, there's some that are $400 and $500 that are, they'll span wider on their footprint, and they'll accept the Evolution legs, and they'll just do all these crazy things. I think for the money, I like Evolution, Atlas, and Harris the best. That's the three I have the most familiarity with. I have one Atlas, and I love it. It's kind of like an Evolution, just with aluminum legs rather than the carbon fiber. You can't take them off, at least as easy. The Evolution just snap right off with no tools, and you can do it mid-stage if you want to in a competition. So that's why I like that one. It's really, really smooth. I think that what I look for in a bipod is something that can swivel first and foremost. Something that's really solid when you rest on it. Some of the knockoff Harris's, they just have a little wobble and a wiggle, and they don't really seem to stay tight on the gun as well. With that little bipod adapter piece, it just seems to kind of get loose really easily, and it just has a little more wobble to it. So I like to stick with what really works, because the truth is you can swap any bipod to any gun in a matter of seconds. It's not that hard to swap it. It's not like a scope where you have to re-zero it and have tools and all this stuff. Usually they're toolless, so that's why I like buying quality bipods, because it really certainly matters quite a bit. Power Level Productions on Instagram also asked, what are essential gear for long range shooting? That's obviously a pretty wide open question, and I could go a long time discussing this, but I think I'll kind of boil it down to some basics. When I started out, I didn't know what I didn't know. And ultimately what I needed to know was more about the consistency of my ammo, how to input things into my ballistic solver, my ballistic calculator. I use Shooter. When you input things in that, if there's anything wrong, your odds are you're going to have a pretty bad day with it. Things that people often overlook are actual velocity, not, you know, the velocity in your box of ammo, your barrel length, and your, you know, a lot of things. Your temperature can change that quite a bit. But also things like the scope over bore measurement. Your solver will ask you how high your scope is over the center of your bore, and that really matters, because if you think about it, you're creating this angle between your scope, where your eye is, and where the bullet is, and you kind of meet those in the middle. So if you're even a half an inch wrong or a quarter inch wrong, it can actually really, really ruin your day as well. So I think get those things really ironed out, make sure your inputs are correct, and then you'll really have a much better day. I would also say just the mechanics and the fundamentals of shooting, at least in a competition long range, make sure that you can cycle through 10 rounds without any hiccups. Sometimes people choose magazines that don't work well with their caliber or their action or their stock even. And there's modifications and there's little things you can do to improve those things. Whether it's, you know, changing, I guess on a J. Allen chassis, you can change where the magazine sits. On a, you know, on a certain caliber, like a BR or a Dasher, you can do magazine follower modifications. But first and foremost, just get those things wrinkled out, because you can have the best gun in the world, show up at a match, and if it doesn't cycle 10 or 12 rounds, you know, in 2 minutes, which you often need to do, you're not going to do nearly as well as that gun can do. And you could be a great shooter and have great, you know, dope and data and everything, and really be set up right. But if you just can't cycle those rounds reliably, then you may as well not go. And then I think that too, practicing outside of a match, I'm kind of focusing on competition if you can't tell, but if you practice outside of a competition, I think so many people, you know, they get away for a Saturday and life's busy and you can finally shoot a match, and it's a stressful thing because I know that we all have family and responsibilities that we're getting away from, but you get away and you're shooting and you're in a deer in the headlights, and you weren't prepared for X, Y, and Z, and holy cow. Well, I like to take notes at a match where I say, I wish I would have X, I wish I would have B, you know, I wish I would have done X, Y, Z. And those notes are super valuable because I can go and practice those things, or buy the right equipment or adjust things. And that way those things usually don't happen again. I kind of learn from my mistakes or my, you know, things, the gear I forgot or things like that. Recently I was shooting a match in Idaho and I just spaced having my dope card for my rifle. I have this dope card that, you know, mounts to my rifle and it sticks out. It's called the Python. By Sidewinder Industries. It's made by Marcus Blanchard. And when I have that on my rifle, it's great. It's like a cheat sheet. It's, you know, I might be shooting five different distances in 2 minutes, maybe two shots a piece. That's kind of a common stage. And I was forced to memorize my dope. So I was memorizing, you know, half a mil, 0.8, 1.2, 1.8, 2.6. I was memorizing that, and I was making it extra hard for myself when I didn't really have to. It was way more work than it had to be, and it was stressful, and I was spending a lot of my brain power, my you know, the calories I was burning, doing something I just really didn't have to do. I should have just had that dope card. So taking notes and learning from those mistakes and learning from others. I think too, in a competition setting, what I've recently really valued is watching other people, for one, how they shoot the stage. Recently we had to shoot off of two big, huge tires, and one was kind of tipped over on the other one, and it was kind of an odd way to shoot. I wouldn't ever have chosen to shoot that way if I had some trophy animal I was shooting at, but I watched a couple shooters, and I went, and I chose to do it a different way, but I think I kind of learned I didn't want to do it how that guy did it, and I do want to do it how this guy does it, and make some modifications. Also, I bought a spotting scope specifically because I wanted to watch where people miss. If you are, say, in a squad of 10 guys and there's your ninth, which is a great spot to be, you can watch eight guys, and if everybody starts missing on the right, well, you can start holding a little bit left and probably not make the mistake they're making. I was at that same match where I forgot my dope card. I luckily was able to spot and watch these shots, and everybody was just a hair low. Everybody, different calibers, different speeds and bullets and guns and everything, but everybody was low. And I look at my friend and I said, "Are you seeing this?" And he said, "Yeah." And so he went next and he held just a little bit high, and he did really well. And I went after him and I held a little high and I did really well. And I think that it was pretty inexplainable why everybody was measuring the same, you know, weather and speed, and we were all kind of collecting our own data and we were all consistently low. But you might as well learn from that. You might as well take advantage of others, you know, just fluke, you know, variables there. So I guess it's hard for me to narrow it down. Obviously I'm rambling on this answer, but I think it's just kind of comes down to the basics. If you're a guy that wants to shoot, you know, on your own property or in public land and just shoot long range, don't rush anything and don't just jump out and, you know, blast away. Take your time and really be methodical about it. I really, really value my friend Curtis Broadbent. He's a phenomenal shooter. Curtis set out a couple of years back to shoot a cold bore shot one day or one time every day for a month. He had a spot he could shoot right by his house, and he went out between, you know, 800 and 1200 yards or so, and he wanted to see if he could shoot his 308 and hit the first shot. And that would just learn, or it would help him learn and understand not only his cold bore shot, but just predict, you know, wind or things like that, and really learn from that. And I think that if you go to the range, and instead of, I mean, obviously you want to check your zero, that's without question, but as long as you're zeroed and you can go and predictably hit 1,000 yards, that's where it gets really fun, because if you can hit 1,000 yards, you can kind of do most anything. And then after that, if you're going to get into PRS or NRL, it's just all about the position from there and about building a foundation to support your shooting. So if you know you're dope, that's a huge part of it. If you have bad dope and a bad position, you just have no hope. So I think that that's a very, very big part of this sport is just the fundamentals and just kind of being able to predictably hit things that you want to hit. And instead of just going to shoot and just, you know, guessing and taking a crack at it and kind of being sloppy about it, I think it's really valuable to be able to predict and be able to without any other data, just say, I'm going to hit this because my calculator says this. I know my data is right and I know I can do it. And here goes. So it's also a lot cooler to show off to your friends to do that too, that don't know how to shoot long range. So I had an experience one time where a friend was semi new to shooting long range, but he was figuring it out, and he decided to bring his dad along, and his dad said he wanted a spot and watch us shoot. And I was getting down ready, and I was, you know, measuring the wind, and I was typing in the, you know, the weather data and things like that. And I was pretty confident with my rifle, and I could normally hit a 2-foot square plate at 1,000 yards on my first shot. And I got ready and I really took my time and squeezed off a good shot. And on this 2-foot square plate, we had about a 2-inch circle in the middle of it, just as a fine aim point. And I kid you not, my first shot the entire day was about 2.5 inches high and left of it. And he was this my friend's dad was looking through the spotting scope saying, okay, I see a splash of, you know, dirt splashing up in the air. It looks like you were low. And I said, no, you see the target, there's the center dot and there's a dot next to it. He said, oh my gosh. He said, I cannot believe you hit that. He was just completely flabbergasted. And I explained to him that, you know, the bullet hit the plate and then the fragments of the bullet hit the ground. And he just was floored. He could not even believe that happened. So anyway, those types of things are really what gets me going. I love being able to just do it one time and be done, and, you know, just not have to walk it in. It just shows, you know, shows the skill a lot more.
IRIS engineer asked, 308 or 6.5 Creedmoor? Well, this question has been passed around for probably 5 or 6 years, and ultimately you can't go wrong with either one, unless you like recoil. There are certainly differences. I honestly think you can probably go wrong. In the sport that I shoot, often precision rifle competitions, I really don't like recoil, because it's not about being a tough guy, like it kind of was when I was young and 18 and buying, you know, Mosin Nagants and shotguns and things like that. I want something that's low recoil because I want to keep my eye on the target. Even when I'm shooting, I want to be able to watch where the bullet's landing, even if at a close range. So if I'm shooting 200 or 300 yards, the bullet's not in the air very long before it hits the ground and may kick up some dust. It may not even. So I want to be able to have as much feedback as I possibly can, and a 6.5 Creedmoor, or for this purpose, I'll include a 6.5 by 47, because they're essentially the same, you know, ballistics and everything. I would say that the 6.5 Creedmoor, or the 6.5 family, has much less recoil. I don't know the exact numbers, and without, you know, doing a test, I couldn't tell you exactly, but I would maybe venture a guess of about a third less recoil. So 2/3 of the recoil. That's a huge difference, and that's a lot of comfort. I remember when I started shooting in these matches, I just remember thinking, this 308 I'm shooting is kicking my butt. It's kind of hurting my collarbone sometimes. It's hurting, you know, this recoil is quite a lot, really. I wasn't using a muzzle brake, and I wasn't using a suppressor. It was just a thread protector on my muzzle thread. That's it. And it was kind of getting tiring after a while, and it was getting really hard to spot my hits or misses. And after I went to the 6.5, it was just so fun because I bought a Savage LRP, Savage 12 LRP, like many of my friends did. It was just a great gun that they did it right, with the exception of the magazines. But anyway, that gun took the recoil way down. It shot flatter, faster, less wind, and it was pretty easy to get factory ammo at the time, even years ago, and now it's really easy. And on top of that, reloading for it was pretty forgiving. So it was kind of an all-around benefit. There was really no downside to running that caliber. Though it still hit targets really hard. In fact, I did the math, and outside of about 150 yards, the 140 grain 6.5 bullet has more energy on target than a, say, 168 grain 30 caliber bullet. So, you know, if you're looking to hunt with it, well, it's going to hit harder after about 150 yards. The added weight of the 30 caliber up close has more energy, but it quickly loses its steam because it's a lower ballistic coefficient. So, yeah, I think a 6.5 Creedmoor would serve almost anybody better, unless you're shooting, you know, something that requires it, like a certain competition. There's certain, military class or NATO class calibers that some matches require, or it puts it in a different division. And then there's also certain NRA style shooting, like F class or FTR, things like that. So anyway, I think that the 6.5 Creedmoor is a great choice. Another great choice even would be a 6 Creedmoor. It's just a 6mm version of a 6.5 Creedmoor. It's not going to have the energy, of course, but it's going to shoot even faster and even flatter over a long, long way, and have a little bit less recoil too. So consider those if you're looking at a 308. I think that you'll be surprised at how much you like it and how easy it is to come by the ammunition if you're buying factory ammunition. Happiness by the Watts asked, what are the top three calibers you will always have? Well, I think that's a really hard question. I think that the nature of my alleged gun collection is that I have, so my bolt action rifle I use in most competitions is a Bighorn TL3. And one of the reasons I like that is because you can take the bolt face and change it. So you can change it from a 308 pattern, so work on a 6.5 Creedmoor, 6.547, you know, there's any number of those, BRs, all those. You can change it to work with like a 223, or you can change it to a Magnum. So you can do a short action Magnum, you can do 308 family, you can do 223. I even have one for a PPC, or that's the same bolt size as a Grendel. So I can run my 224 Grendels through my big full-size short action bolt action. So it kind of breeds this collection of barrels, because I can take the barrels off, I have a vise, I have a wrench, I can break the action loose off the barrel and twist it off, just like I'm taking a, you know, muzzle brake off or something like that. But on the other end, I twist it off and I put it on a new barrel. And so I can change calibers in about 3 or 4 minutes. And, you know, it's great. It's a great system. So because of that, I have a lot of calibers, actually. I think just for the Bighorn TL3, I have 223, I have 22 BR, I have 22 Dasher, I have 6 Dasher, I have 647, I actually have a 7 Somme barrel coming, and I have a 6 BR barrel coming. So I think that's 7 barrels for one action. And, you know, most of those are the 308 bolt pattern, so that's you know, not a tremendous need for the other ones. But I plan on doing a 224 Grindle on one. I plan on doing the 7 Somme, the 223 I already have. I love shooting that. So anyway, I have a lot of calibers. And in answering this question, I thought about it for a few minutes, and I think I'm going to have to break it down in categories of, I'm going to include pistols, ARs, and bolt actions, because it's kind of the main three. I'm not really counting shotgun, because it's kind of one real, you know, it's only one choice for a shotgun, of course, and that's 410. Just kidding. So in bolt action, I'm going to name a couple, and I'm going to name a couple in ARs. I'm going to name a couple, well, maybe one in pistol, but anyway, of course, 22 long rifle across the board. You got to have a 22 long rifle basically in everything. Incredibly cheap to shoot. Kids can shoot it. It's fun to suppress. It's everyone's wife's favorite caliber, usually. I mean, unless your wife's really into guns and is used to more recoil and things like that, or more concussion. I have really thoroughly enjoyed my 6.5 Creedmoor, or my 6.5 by 47 Lapua. That was my first real custom gun. It wasn't on a custom action. I sent a Remington action to GA Precision in Missouri, and they did a great job. It's an amazing gun, and I've rarely seen guns that can shoot as well as that gun. From there, I went and built a custom action 6.47 on my Bighorn, and I've never done better in a centerfire match with that gun. I was in a very large body of extremely capable shooters, and I came in the top three, and I was kind of unprepared feeling, but I walked away with a really, really just clean match that was, you know, very consistent. I just shot just like I always did, and it just turned out really well with that. So that caliber has a really special place for me. And then the third is probably that 22 BR I'm doing right now. That has just been so much fun, and it's honestly kind of caught the attention of a lot of my shooting colleagues. I don't claim to be the first 22 BR in the world. Obviously, it's been around for 50 plus years, but I ordered a barrel and had the bullets and the brass very early on in this trend of going down in bullet diameter and even bullet weight, kind of, because as the diameter changes, obviously the weight does. So this BR has been so fun because it's very low recoil, it's very forgiving to reload for. I'm using, let's see, let me do the math. I'm using 10 grains less powder from my 6.47 to the 22 BR, and I'm shooting a bullet that weighs 22 grains less, so 110 down to 88. And I'm shooting that bullet basically the same speed. So, of course, bullet weight difference, but same speed, but with 10 grains less powder. So it's just been really fun to play with that one. It's, if you've ever seen one, maybe I'll post a picture soon. It's a tiny, short little cartridge. It's just so fun. I don't know. There's just like something just cool about it. I feel like I'm kind of bridging the gap between a 22 long rifle, or 223 especially, and the Creedmoor family, or the 47 families. So yeah, I think that's the three big bolt action calibers. I can really expand this a lot further and kind of go over everything and why, but I think, you know, sometime soon I might say the 7 Somme will be a favorite, because it's going to be kind of exclusively, you know, I don't hunt a ton, but I think it'll be a great hunting ground. Obviously, it's been proven. I also think there's once in a while some reason to go out and shoot 2,000 yards, and I can absolutely do that, no problem. So, that's the top 3 or 4 or 5 bolt action. As far as pistol, I'm just going to say 9mm and 22. It's just kind of a no-brainer. There's some kind of exotics out there. I've been intrigued by a 22 TCM and a 9x25 Dillon, and you know, a 45 is fun to suppress because it's so slow and quiet. But anyway, in AR calibers, I'm going to say, obviously, 223 is a no-brainer. You've got to go with that. Tremendously, you know, underrated caliber. That actually goes for both actions as well. We shoot those very, very well in both actions. And it's an incredibly efficient round, too. But in AR, you know, I've shot mine 1,000 yards, no problem. It's not like it's a walk in the park, but it's certainly able to do that, and it's consistent and it's accurate. I'll take it a step further and say my 224 Grendel barrels that I sell at www.tacticalcannon.com, I would say that is a very, very fun caliber because it's kind of like a miniature 22 BR. It's just barely a smaller case head or rim, and it's a little shorter, and it's just a kind of a scaled down version of that, just barely. It almost holds the same amount of powder, but I'm using a ball powder in that, so it kind of fills the voids completely, where a stick powder like Varget in a 22BR won't quite fill every little gap and void. So I'm actually using basically the same weight, if not more powder, in the 224 Grendel, but in the BR, I would argue I'm using better powders, just more consistent burning and less temperature sensitive. But the 224 Grendel, the 224 Grendel, for those who don't know, it's something that I didn't develop, but I thought was missing from the modern sporting rifle or modern AR-15 lineup. People have done it in the past where there's, you know, uppers for sale. The whole upper is for sale only, nothing else. And I didn't like the handguard. I didn't like the barrel length. I didn't like the barrel twists. I didn't like the price, especially. So I didn't want a 28-inch barrel. I didn't want kind of a DPMS, old-school, aluminum, circular handguard. I didn't want a rifle-length gas tube. There's a lot of things about it I didn't like. I didn't like the price of a $1,300 or $1,400 AR upper that was kind of basic. Still a great caliber, but it didn't grab me. And then someone else has done it where they do a 20-inch barrel and a kind of a slow twist and kind of a less than desirable material. And again, a rifle length gas system. I didn't think that was ideal. So there's a lot of things that I thought there was a gap in the market. And for so many people, especially people who would buy a Wildcat caliber, they want to build their own. Let them choose their handguard. Let them choose their gas block. Let them choose their muzzle device. Let them choose their upper, their bolt, everything. Let them choose. That's the beauty of an AR-15, is most people without really any experience can watch a YouTube video and build their own safely. So I introduced, just about a year ago now, the first kind of highly customizable 224 Grendel barrel. And I released a 24-inch, plus two, so it's a rifle plus 2-inch gas system, so it's an extended long gas system. It's a 7 twist, like I said, stainless steel, and I have 5/8 muzzle threads on it, because who doesn't have a 5/8 muzzle accessory? It seems very, very common. But it just seemed like that was such an easy decision to do that, and they've been selling like crazy. There's a lot of people out there competing with them now. I've got clients sending me pictures of groups and, you know, dead bucks and things like that that they're just super excited about. And I've never been in this role before as someone who's providing people with a tool to extend their AR-15's accuracy or distance or things like that. And people are just thrilled with it. One customer out of Kansas has sent me groups and load data, and he seems like a really smart guy. He sent me groups that are 1.6 inches at 600 yards, so under a third minute of angle. I've got guys in Texas sending me pictures of them at matches with it, and they get third place, and they just got the barrel. You know, it's just like crazy what they can do with it. We've got coyote hunters in, you know, Nebraska that are just loving it, and they're just blasting coyotes left and right. So yeah, I think that 224 Grendel, for me, it's a very special caliber. It's the first real product I've really manufactured and sold and, you know, made an e-commerce website and done just A to Z for. So for those of you who are wondering more about it, I guess I'll do a whole podcast about that caliber. But I think it's really hard to beat it in an AR-15. It stomped on the Valkyrie, and I think you, if you follow me on Instagram or Facebook, you probably have seen me kind of snicker or trash talk the Valkyrie, and I think that a lot of people are kind of seeing the Valkyrie for what I thought it was. I thought it wasn't quite the right parent case. I thought there wasn't a whole lot of bolt offerings, which obviously there are now. I don't think that it was the right parent case. I just thought that it was not a, you know, not a known cartridge for accuracy, 6.8 SPC. But I thought the PPC, the 22 or 6 PPC, is an incredibly highly regarded bench rest caliber. It's one of those that people say is just inherently accurate. Well, let's put it in an AR-15, kind of like Alexander Arms thought to do with a 6.5 Grendel. I thought, well, these are better bullets. They're lighter bullets. They're 224 bullets are better, you know. They're lighter. They're higher BC. They go way faster. They're cheaper. Why wouldn't we do the 224? I have friends that have 6mm variants of a Grendel, and they shoot amazing. They're incredible rounds. But I thought, let's take it a step further, because these 80 ELDs, the 80 VLDs, the 88 ELDs, the 95 SMKs, the 90 SMKs, all these things are becoming available, and they're very, 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 very highly respected bullets already. So anyway, I think that's a very, very obvious caliber that I would select. And then the third is a 300 Blackout. I think there was a huge, huge, just jaw drop that happened, you know, maybe 2012, 13, 14-ish, maybe right around there. And I think that the Blackout kind of really sparked a fire with people wanting to, one, own suppressors, and then two, reload. Those bullets are not cheap in a 300 Blackout. They're big and heavy, and there's a lot of copper and a lot of lead. And, you know, if you're going to shoot like a Sierra Match King, you're like 40 or 50 cents a bullet. It's kind of expensive. But people are getting into shooting cast bullets now, and people are getting into, you know, casting their own stuff or using, you know, the reloading presses that they got, you know, for Christmas and they never use. They're using it now to reload for this fun little caliber, and it's fun with the super low recoil, and it's very, very quiet when it's subsonic and suppressed, and it hits hard if it's supersonic. So I just like the versatility of it. I've kind of been sticking with it, and, you know, I think I had an SBR made in, I think it was 2012, so it's been almost 7 years now. I can't believe that. But that suppressor took like 13 months to get. That was my first one, and it was just a great, great round, and I've really never looked back. I think I've got two bolt actions in it now, and I've got two ARs, I've got two SBR even, 300 Blackouts now. So I'm a fan, if you can't tell. So anyway, that's kind of the rundown. Sorry it wasn't this three, it was kind of like 15 calibers. Sorry about that. But anyway, I'm sure if you guys have any questions, please email or PM me.
LMorris9935 asked, why 22 long rifle?
Well, why not? my experience with it was I was introduced to a local 22 competition. Now, this is not like my first introduction to 22 shooting, of course. I've had 22s as a, you know, teenager and things like that, but my friends, you know, I kind of made friends with the friends of the friend, you know, this chain reaction of people I met, and they were shooting this competition in Springville, Utah, called the 22 Marksman Challenge, and that's kind of where my screen name came from, obviously. But I showed up, and I thought, I'm going to kick these guys' butts, and I came very outgunned, and I came very unprepared, and I got humbled. I brought a rifle with aperture sights, so no magnification, and basically every stage was them shooting paper at 25 to 100 yards. And it was impossible, absolutely impossible to use that gun because I couldn't see, you know, the tiny little targets they're shooting at 100 yards. You know, I couldn't identify even my own paper, let alone where on the paper to shoot. So anyway,
That's kind of where it started, and it kind of rolled into an obsession of, I can do better. I can beat these guys. I know I'm a good shooter, and I'll show them, and I'll, you know, it was a pride thing a little bit. But that first match, I got dead last place. I scored minus 9 points, and I thought, that's it. I'm going to get the right gear and show them a thing or two, because I didn't realize this was, you know, this is a big mistake I made not being prepared. So I came back, and I did better the next time, and it made some adjustments to my rifle. I had a Savage Mark II TR, and then after that, I had changed to a CZ 455 with a Lilja barrel, and my first match with that, I got second place overall, and from there, it just kind of got to be, I was in the top three regularly just about, and I would win a lot, and people were asking my advice suddenly, and I kind of seemed to be the guy who knew what he was doing, even though I didn't feel like I was, you know, anything different than anybody else. But I started doing really well, and I was kind of becoming respected and understood as, you know, one of the top two or three shooters. So anyway, that's kind of my start in it, and it's evolved in the National Rifle League, where I'm the match director for the largest match in the National Rifle League. We have between 35 and 45 shooters every month, and it's just incredibly good practice for long range shooting. It's just like a scaled down version. I would say it's cheaper, but it's probably not cheaper, because the ammo we shoot is not cheap. But it's just a scaled down, simplified version of the long range matches that I like to do a lot. Instead of needing a 1,000-yard range, you can use a 100-yard range. Instead of needing to reload and all these things, you can just buy a box and you're set to go. So it's blossomed into quite a neat thing. I have the largest match in the NRL 22. There's over, I think, 60 clubs shooting the NRL 22 now, and I've got the largest one in the nation that really stemmed from my relationships with other people in the other match we shot. I think in the NRL 22 finale this past May of 18, there were 69 shooters, and in the top 10, I think 6 or 8 of them were from my match. So we have good shooters. We have a lot of shooters. In a way, we've had a head start doing this game. We have really good rifles and really good techniques, and I'm sure that the rest of the country is looking at us like we lead it, but there's certainly a lot of good shooters across the nation that are just blowing my mind how good they are. So it's we're not riding that wave of the head start anymore, it looks like. So anyway, the 22 thing, I think it's just, it's fun to do simple things on an extreme scale. People do simple things on extreme scale. You can race, you know, Razor scooters. You can do things like that where it's kind of, there's kind of a ceiling. You know, nobody has an edge ballistically over anybody, but, you know, there are obvious benefits to rifles or triggers or scopes or things like that. But we're all on the same plane with our ammunition. It's all capped. We're all even. And I really like that quite a bit.